Well, I've had a couple of Democrats ask me, including, by the way, my sister-in-law, ask me why I'm so hard on Democrats, and I'll tell you why. But first, let me say that anybody in this day and time who is in lockstep with either political party needs to open their eyes and ears. This country is in trouble and squabbling for power by two parties that can only harm us. We don't need. Now, why be critical of Democrats? Well, let's take a look. They gave us 8 years of Barack Obama, a man who hates what this country stands for and who did all he could to bring us down to the level of the rest of the world. Do we not want presidents who want to move us up and not bring us down? Democrats gave us Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Elijah Cummings, Maxine Waters, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Donna Brazile, Hillary Clinton, and a host of far-left progressives who took this country steadily to the left. The truth is that the Democratic Party's far left has taken themselves far away from you. The party has gone so far to the left that any of you who do not endorse political correctness, moral decay, and the non-belief in God need to re-examine your priorities. If you cannot see that, you simply don't want to see it. Now, that doesn't mean that I totally endorse Republicans either. While we see Democrats banded together on issues like sardines in a can, Republicans form a circle and start shooting one another. They should get into a room, hash out their differences, and reach a consensus. Otherwise, Democrats will run all over them from a minority position. And I see the danger from both parties. The mainstream media and fanatical career Democrats happily declared a major defeat for President Trump when the first attempt at repeal and replace Obamacare failed in Congress. Trump had been in office just 64 days. It's a bit premature to celebrate victory. The truth is that Democrats know full well that Obamacare will collapse by the end of this year. 2017 will see even greater rate hikes for Obamacare and larger deductibles. The bogus argument that millions would have lost their health care is laughable. They would lose health care only if they decided to not allow the government to force them to take Obamacare. Make no mistake, the enormous amount of money that flows to politicians from drug firms and insurance companies keeps any real reform of health care from happening. Both sides of the aisle are guilty of valuing money over the American people. Not one Democrat broke ranks to support a health care reform bill. Surely these career Democrats should realize that by opposing en masse every single thing that Trump proposes, the American people are going to see through the fake outrage. It's all about greed and power, and we're all caught in the middle. Chuck Schumer, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, has even said they would filibuster to keep Judge Gorsuch from moving on to the Supreme Court. Any rational person can see that Gorsuch is more than qualified for the court, and that the Democrats are simply opposing him to strike at President Trump. When Trump vowed to drain the swamp, it was this kind of activity that he meant. Career Democratic politicians don't want the swamp to be drained. They worked with liberals for decades to infest the swamp. They live and thrive in the swamp. And they're joined by some sleazy Republicans who want the swamp left just the way they built it. Last Wednesday in London, another terrorist attack took the lives of innocent people and maimed others. Again, a car was used to mow down people, and a knife was used by the terrorists to stab a policeman to death. This was a mindless, grisly attack by a Muslim fanatic. The only time a gun was used was when police shot the terrorist dead. We are due a major attack, and our major cities are again having to go on alert. Each time this happens, our taxpayers get hit with the massive costs of trying to protect our security. For more than 1,000 years, Muslims have migrated to other countries, and as long as their numbers are small, we find that they are fairly peaceful. That's on the surface. Far too many of them plot and plan for the day that the number of Muslims in a particular country grows large enough for them to go on offense against that country. We see it in Europe, the results of unfettered immigration from Muslim countries. For years, we heard nothing from these Muslim refugees in Europe. But when their population grew to large numbers, they emerged to go on offense. There are sections in London and other foreign cities where Muslims dominate, and police are afraid to even enter those. We have sectors in the United States where police fear to enter. There are areas here where black violence keeps police leery of entering the territory. But blacks are killing other blacks, whereas these Islamic terrorists don't care who they kill. Already in America, we see Muslims in sufficient numbers to feel confident into beginning to gather in large groups to make demands for this country to adopt the lifestyles they left behind in the Middle East. They feel comfortable in demanding that America bow to their demand that Sharia law be the law of America. While we have had a few terrorist attacks over the years, we are overdue for a major attack from Islamic terrorists who have gotten themselves into this country and have plotted and planned for years to launch an attack that would take the most lives of Americans. I consider all of those liberal Americans who try to block efforts by the president to get a handle on who's coming to America and what their motives are to be as much of a terrorist as the Islamic terrorists themselves. It is mindless and reckless to not recognize that it is not the color of their skin or even their religion that causes us to need to vet these immigrants more extremely than an immigrant from Norway or Ireland. It is their ideology. Not every Muslim is a terrorist, but almost all terrorists are Muslims. That is reason enough to try and cull the violent ones out of those we allow to enter our country. Let me give you a hypothetical instance. Let's say there are 10 dogs outside of your home. Some are rabid, some are harmless. Would you not be careful of which ones you invited in? Now, what if there were people who insisted that you not be allowed to even see the dogs, much less vet them before they're allowed to enter your house? Does that make any sense to you? If so, you're a liberal, and more often than not, a Democrat. If we continue to allow Muslim refugees into America without extreme vetting, their numbers will inevitably grow large enough to go on offense against us, just as they have done in Europe. This isn't conjecture, it's a fact. History shows us that in every country where Muslims have amassed a large enough percentage of the population, they have turned on the host country. These Muslims know what the laws and customs are in the countries they seek to enter, and they know that the customs of the countries they are leaving are completely different, and still they come. Why? It seems obvious to all but the naive among us that their aim is to impose their will on the host country that allows them in. That is consistent with Islam's call for world domination. You can't stay in Yemen and dominate the United States. But if you and your companions gain entry to America, you can use our freedoms against us to seek the world domination that is demanded by Islam. When the next massive attack happens here, and it will happen, it will be far more deadly than the attacks of 9/11/2001. Many innocent Americans will die at the hands of fanatical Islamic terrorists who are ignorant enough to believe that their God, Allah, demands them to kill non-believers. and who conned liberal America into downplaying their threat against us. It is not enough that we stand up for our country, our families, our flag, and our God against Islamic terrorism, but that we also stand up against those Americans who put us into danger in their zeal to be politically correct, and who refuse to see the danger of Islamic terrorism. These Americans are terrorists in their own right. I've done a good bit of research on our educational system. U.S. public schools are progressive indoctrination camps. While there are still a few schools, especially in small southern communities, that will not tolerate the assault from liberal teachers, they are in the minority. Under pressure from teachers' unions, why should liberals want to make changes to the public education system when it's turning out the product they've been striving for years to produce? If you think I exaggerate, listen to these real news headlines from the past about the state of the United States public education. U.S. teachers tell us that sex is a spectrum, advocate mandatory classes to free students from religion. Here's a new newspaper headline: Principal orders 10 commandments yanked from schools' lockers. Another read: Teens ask for more sex ed, greater condom availability. These are real newspaper headlines from the past few years, and I'll list a few more. State University defines Christians as oppressors. No opting out of pro-gay school propaganda. And then this headline: Some say schools giving Muslims special treatment. There are many other headlines, but you get the picture. These are real newspaper headlines, and they demonstrate how serious the problem is in our public school system. On December 27, 1820, Thomas Jefferson wrote about his vision for the University of Virginia, which was chartered in 1819. Jefferson said, "This institution will be based on the freedom of the human mind, for here we are not afraid to follow the truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error as long as reason is left free to combat it." But what should happen 200 years later when our public schools and universities avoid the telling of truth or suppress alternate opinions because they are unpopular or politically incorrect, or no longer tolerate opinions now considered errors or obsolete by the elite? What happens when socio-political agendas dominate academic views to the exclusion of a minority even being mentioned? What happens when the political and public educational pendulum swings from the concern for the tyranny of sectarianism in Jefferson's day to secularism in ours? What happens when U.S. public schools become progressive indoctrination camps? My oldest granddaughter narrowed her colleges to the University of Virginia and Meredith College, where her mother had graduated. I held my breath and prayed that the values she had been taught by her family would guide her to the right decision. The University of Virginia is still a great school on many levels, but its faculty leans far left. Anna finally chose Meredith College. Meredith is not perfect, and there are a few left-wing professors there, but my daughter spent 4 years there and survived with her conservative values still in place. Thomas Jefferson would not recognize his university today, with its campus filled with whimpering snowflakes who take political correctness to a new level. Dr. Jim Nelson Black, founder and senior policy analyst of the Sentinel Research Associates in Washington, D.C., wrote an excellent book titled Free Fall of the American University. In it, he documents the clear biases pervading our public academic settings. Among that lopsidedness is the intentional training of students to disdain America, to freely experiment sexually, forcefully defend issues like abortion and homosexuality, as well as become cultural advocates for political correctness, relativism, globalization, green agendas, and tolerance for all. Yet they are the most intolerant. One of the primary ways these educative platforms are spread is by recruiting and retaining faculty members who reflect and teach them. For example, citing from the polling firm of Luntz Research, Dr. Black notes that 57% of faculty members represented in our most esteemed universities are Democrats. Only 3 are Republicans. 64% of them identify themselves as a liberal, while only 6% are conservative. Moreover, 71% of them disagree that news coverage of political and social issues reflects a liberal bias in the news media. And the number one answer these professors gave to the question, who has been the best president in the past 40 years, was Bill Clinton. Only 4% said Ronald Reagan. That's why there is no surprise that the two largest teachers' unions, the NEA and the AFT, are the largest campaign contributors in the nation, giving more than the Teamsters, the NRA, or any other organization, and that 90% of their contributions fund Democratic candidates. In doing so, who thinks that such funding is going to balance traditional and conservative values in our schools? Is it any wonder that Democratic politicians have no interest in correcting the public educational system's faults? Money talks in politics, and the teachers' unions have lots of money to toss around to those who promise the status quo. The impact of progressivism is being experienced by students across America, hundreds of thousands of whom have already cried out with complaints of academic inequity. It is no surprise that an average of 6,000 students every year are leaving the approximately 94,000 public schools in America. If the power to be over our public school systems, like government and unions, continue to oppose conservative curricula and impose overarching liberal educational revisions and laws, public schools will continue to experience an exodus of students. In this present restrictive and one-sided educational environment, that which Thomas Jefferson and other founders intended for the future generations of America, is that what they wanted? Absolutely not. Rather than encourage free thinking, the U.S. academic system has turned Jefferson's plans for open education into our culture's present system of indoctrination. Today, there are over 10,000 openly Marxist professors and thousands of humanist professors controlling our universities and colleges that produce America's teachers and other professionals. Varying forms of Marxist and humanism are the predominant philosophies of the educational establishment. Yet we repeatedly send our most precious gift, our children, off to them for education, only to experience indoctrination. Today's schools are filled with sex education, political correctness, environmental extremism, global unity, diversity training, pro-homosexuality, and higher-order thinking skills, which boldly proclaim that to become a higher-order thinker, one must first believe the fact that there are absolutely no absolutes. The Bible was America's first textbook, yet today it's referred to as a book of fables. Let alone used in American public schools, our schools are filled with murder, violence, extortion, rape, unwanted pregnancy, drug use, disrespect, foul language, declining test scores, and children who cannot read. While the pontificators wonder why, God doesn't wonder. He knows. Hosea chapter 4, verses 4 through 7 reads, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I will also reject thee, seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God. I will also forget thee, thy children, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore I will change their glory into shame. The problem with America's educational system began with the birth of socialism and given impetus by federal government involvement. One of the world's leading experts on socialism tells us that communism is socialism in a hurry. Socialism, therefore, is communism by gradualism, than by revolution. The socialist Fabian Society, the forerunner of most socialist groups in America, has as their motto, "Make haste slowly." Democratic socialism became the battle cry to socialize the United States of America. The socialist goal was to permeate and penetrate, then control America from deep within. Their first target in America was our children through public instruction. Their followers would use language as their first line of attack and deceit. They would wear no badge or socialist label, but were to call themselves liberal progressives, or even moderate words were the weapon of choice for this war. By changing and shifting word meanings, the socialists could cover their true purpose. Everything would be done under the banner of reform and social justice, suggesting that all was for the public good, for humanitarian reasons, for true democracy, and finally, for the children. The buzzwords of socialism were then and are today social and democracy. Robert Conquest observed that a communist never does anything under their own name that they can do under someone else's name. In the early 1900s, because of unrest in Europe, thousands of socialists flocked to America for safety. Large numbers of them held degrees in the fields of psychology, sociology, and psychiatry. Many went on to become college and university professors in America. Norman Thomas, a socialist and member of the Civil Liberties Union, boldly told the world that the American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt socialism. They will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without ever knowing what happened. The average, ordinary American does not fully understand how deep into our public education system the socialists have ingrained themselves. The story of how the socialists took over the American educational system establishment would fill a book. So listen to their own words. John Dewey was called the father of modern education, but he was an avowed socialist, the co-author of the Humanist Manifesto, and cited as belonging to 15 Marxist front organizations by the Committee on Un-American Activities. Dewey taught professors who would later train America's new teachers. Dewey said this, "You can't make socialists out of individualists. Children who know how to think for themselves spoil the harmony of the collective society which is coming, where everyone is interdependent on the group." Rosalie Gordon, writing on Dewey's progressive education in her book, What's Happened to Our Schools, said this, "The progressive system has reached all the way down to the lowest grades to prepare the children of America for their role as the collectivists of the future. The group, new, not the individual child, is the focus of progressivism. The child must also be made to feel part of a group. They must indulge in group thinking and group activity." After visiting the Soviet Union, Dewey wrote 6 articles on the wonders of the Soviet education. The school-to-work system in our public schools is modeled after the Soviet polytechnical system. Listen carefully. In 1936, the National Education Association, the NEA, stated its position, from which they have never wavered. They said this: "We stand for socializing the individual." The NEA and its policy for American education stated that the major problem of education in our times arises out of the fact that we live in a period of fundamental social change, the major function at the school. They said it's social orientation of the individual, and you thought the major function of the school was educating our young. I did too. Paul Harbor, the specialist for the NEA, tells us the schools cannot allow parents to influence the kind of values education their children receive in school. Our goals are incompatible with theirs. We must change their values. That's a specialist for the NEA. Please stay tuned because there's more. Professor Chester Pierce, a professor of education and psychiatry at Harvard, had this to say: "Every child in America entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill because they come to school with certain allegiances to our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward their parents, toward a belief in a supernatural being, and towards the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It's up to us as teachers to make all of these sick children well by creating the international child of the future." You heard me right. This buffoon is teaching at Harvard. His idea of utopia is stripping our children of their belief in God, the Constitution, and the sovereignty of our country. He sees it as his job to re-educate children from the lessons of their parents. Can we not see the danger in allowing people like this to micromanage our children? Some politicians agree with Pierce's thinking. Senator Paul Hoagland of Nebraska said that the fundamentalist parents have no right to indoctrinate their children to their beliefs. "We are preparing children to live in a global one-world society, and those children will not fit in." Paul Blanchard wrote in The Humanist in 1983 that the most important factor moving us toward a secular society has been the educational factor. Our schools may not teach Johnny how to read properly, but the fact that Johnny is in school until he is 16 tends to toward the elimination of religious superstition. Then there's John Dunphy, who wrote back in 1983 that the battle for mankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classroom. The classroom must and will become the arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity and the new faith in humanism. This attack against God and Christianity is a constant theme among socialists. It's not enough for them not to believe in God. They see it as their duty to turn our children away from Christianity. Our bureaucrats, politicians, and educators are constantly on television blaming either the parents or the lack of money for their schools' dilemmas. The answer is always more money and more government control. For well over 50 years, the American voter has believed this line of garbage. Victor Golontz, a famous socialist publisher, tells us why he believes that socialism will take over America. He said this: "Christians are not exactly bright, so it will be easy for socialism to lead them down the garden path through their ideals of brotherly love and social justice." That opinion is shared among progressives. When there is an inequity as great as 9 liberal professors to 1 conservative professor in college, it is impossible to believe that the students are receiving a fair and balanced education. The question is not whether the imbalance should remain. It must not, because all schools shall equal the diversity that exists in the public domain. The problem is how to correct the injustice of schools dominated by liberals and liberal thought. Change is difficult, especially when those guilty of causing it are unwilling to give up the dominance they currently enjoy. One question often asked is how this highly liberal imbalance occurred in the first place. Some claim it was because of the debate and opposition to the Vietnam War. That war became a catalyst for radicals to create chaos in America and ended up with radicals bombing facilities in the United States, causing destruction and death. Parents expect colleges to teach facts and methods, but not specific philosophical ideals that are controversial. Parents believe it is most important for professors to explain both sides of controversial issues, give students the opportunity to discern for themselves what they want to believe. Success beyond college is often determined by more than just knowledge, but by students who have been given the opportunity and advantage of hearing and knowing both sides of the political debate, and thus able to better understand the other opinions while comfortably committed to their own belief system. Adding to our concern is the fact that today's teachers and those of tomorrow have been affected by the liberal professors on campuses across America. To be sure, we have many good and even great teachers in our K-12 education system, but they are overshadowed by a larger share of teachers who were indoctrinated in college. Teachers' unions, like the NEA and their socialist beliefs, have made it almost impossible to fire a bad teacher. It takes mounds of paperwork to move against a teacher, and principals just tire of the effort. That means the bad teachers are either left in place or transferred to another school. Liberals who prefer academia honestly believe that they are superior in thought to conservatives and that conservatives are best left to the military or the clergy. The liberal activists failed in their revolt against America in the 60s, and their hope for fundamentally changing our country was stalled until the election of Barack Hussein Obama. Let me tell you today about former left-wing radicals who became professors in America's schools. Kathy Boden was convicted in 1984 of felony murder for her participation in a Brinks robbery where two police officers and a security guard were killed. She served a term in prison, but then landed a teaching job at Columbia University in 2013. Perhaps the most famous example of a radical who became a professor is Bill Ayers. He was the leader of the Weather Underground anarchist bombers of the 60s. Bill Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, both became professors. Dorn's tenure on the FBI's most wanted list did not deter the University of Illinois or Northwestern University from hiring her. Bill Ayers is unrepentant and is now retired from the University of Chicago. Howard Machtinger also was a Weather Underground bomber and spent the 1970s underground attempting the prosecution on a variety of charges, including a foiled attempt to bomb the Detroit Police Officers Association building. Nevertheless, before retiring, Machtinger became a North Carolina Central University and Teaching Fellows Director of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Education. There are too many radicals to report on them all. As stated in Michael Moynihan's book, How 1960s Radicals Wound Up Teaching Your Kids, so go ahead and commit a crime, expropriate a bank. Just make sure you leave an incoherent manifesto for the media, claiming that you are shooting your guns and filling your pockets with loot for the people. Because when caught, you won't be a convicted murderer, but a political professor, a prisoner, who, when released, can become a college professor. Before becoming a professor at the University of Illinois, James Kilgore had been a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army in the 1970s. He spent time in prison for his part in a bank robbery in which a victim was murdered. When the story finally emerged, the university had to fire him. But the university trustees found a way to rehire him as a part-time professor. That shows the lengths that liberals would go to hire their own. When the people demand equality and fairness in universities' hiring practices, we can expect a positive turn in the right direction. when and if that is to happen depends upon each of us. Don't send your children to college because the campus is beautiful. The gardeners do that, not the educators. Don't rely on a love for athletic teams. Look into who is going to be teaching your children. I'm going to close today with something I sometimes do, but which I should do more often, and that is to affirm my belief in God and in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and my Lord and Savior. Christianity is under constant attack around the world, but especially here in our own country. I spoke today about the denigration of God on college campuses. These wretched people dominate thought unless God's people stand up to them, and I pledge to do that more often, as I ask you to do the same. It's not necessarily about organized religion, but about individual belief. Frankly, most, if not all of us, take God for granted. There have been times in all of our lives when somebody has abused us, cursed us, or betrayed us. We all have that in common, but a patient God has allowed us the freedom to make our mistakes without retribution. I can only surmise that He wants us to correct ourselves and is willing to allow us to disappoint Him again and again in hopes that we will one day mature and seek His forgiveness. I don't force my belief in God on others, but I am willing to testify on His behalf. Atheists, on the other hand, not only don't believe in God, but spend much of their time trying to discourage those of us who do. They file lawsuits against followers of a God who they say does not exist. Why would something that does not exist trouble them? The answer is because deep down inside them there is the nagging concern that they are wrong. So stand up and speak out for what you believe in, and let nobody cast doubt upon you. It is the least we can do for all of the blessings we have received. That's my mini sermon for today, heartfelt and honest.